price of oil, half our income went away, and we're in about a $3 billion deficit.
A sobering message, along with a record permanent fund dividend. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an effort to repeal the hefty Cadillac tax that could affect most health plans in Alaska in 2 years.
Our plans cost more because we are a high-cost state with high-cost insurance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
A record-breaking permanent fund dividend was announced this morning, not from the governor, but instead from a 12-year-old student. Because, according to Governor Bill Walker, the fund is really about the next generation. Shania Summer, a 7th grader at Palmer Junior Middle School, is involved in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program.
The amount is $2,072.
Without adjusting for inflation, this is the largest amount received by Alaskans in the history of the permanent fund dividend. The previous record was set in 2008, when dividend checks came in at $2,069. Governor Walker says this is the first time in Alaska's history the earnings of the permanent fund have exceeded the earnings from oil.
So we're in a bit of a dilemma this year, given that with the price of oil, half our income went away. And we're in about a $3 billion deficit. So this year we'll be looking at ways of balancing the budget with a plan going forward. We'll work with the legislature on that.
Permanent fund dividend payouts are based on a 5-year average of the fund's income. Alaska's two U.S. senators are co-sponsoring legislation to repeal the so-called Cadillac tax, which will impact high-priced employer health plans starting in 2018. Because health care is so expensive in Alaska, the tax will have a disproportionate impact in the state. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
The tax was designed to hit high-end employer health plans that include especially rich benefits. But Senator Lisa Murkowski says in Alaska, it will impact health plans that are a lot more average.
Our plans cost more because we are a high-cost state with high-cost insurance.
Starting in 2018, employers will pay a 40% tax on health insurance plans that cost more than about $10,000 a year for an individual and $27,000 a year for families. The tax applies to any amount above those thresholds. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates it will impact a quarter of individual plans nationwide in 2018. Senator Murkowski says repealing the tax has a lot of support from Alaska employers.
So it's a very mixed group of Alaskans. It's municipal entities, it's the public entities like the school districts, and it is private small businesses out there as well.
Murkowski says the legislation has bipartisan support in Congress. Two similar bills have been introduced in the U.S. House. But she says the Obama administration is adamantly opposed to repealing the tax, in part because they're counting on the revenue to help pay for other provisions in the Affordable Care Act. Fred Brown is executive director of the Health Care Cost Management Corporation of Alaska, a nonprofit that oversees about 40 health plans in Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. He says the tax will apply to most employer health plans in Alaska starting in 2018. Brown supports repealing the tax, but says at the very least it should be amended.
There should, at a minimum, be a carve-out recognition of the geographical differential higher costs that we in Alaska and other high-cost states would experience.
Brown says employers are already starting to plan for the tax as they design future employee health plans. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
Local hearings are happening this week on the planned basing of 54 F-35 fighter jets at Eielson Air Force Base. The sessions in North Pole, Delta, and Fairbanks provide an opportunity to comment on a draft environmental impact statement on the basing plan. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Eielson is the only base the Air Force is considering for the stationing of F-35 fighters outside the continental U.S., but it still has to go through a review process and consider a no-action alternative. North Pole Economic Development Corporation Executive Director Nadine Winters describes the draft environmental impact statement as a big document to digest, but says a few issues rise to the top.
They came up with two areas of significant impact, and one is that they're going to have to fill in 13 acres of wetlands at Eielson for some of the construction, and the other one is that there's potentially noise impacts, mostly affecting the people on post and people in Moose Creek.
Winters says other issues covered in the EIS are categorized as either no impact or positive.
2,765 people. It's 1,500 basically new jobs, that's military and civilian, and then 1,200 dependent military dependents. So there's that influx. And then for the ongoing maintenance and operations of those two squadrons, they're talking another 2,300 new jobs, which is pretty significant.
Winter says all the new people will also have a positive impact on real estate and school vacancies. The F-35 fighter was recently declared operational by the military despite a mixed performance report by the Pentagon. The F-35 has also drawn criticism for its extreme cost, which can run to more than $125 million per aircraft. Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation President and CEO Jim Dodson lays out spending that will translate locally if the jets are based at Eielson.
The construction that will facilitate the basing of the F-35s in Fairbanks amounts to almost $500 million. It'll have an additional economic impact on the community of an annual $280 million.
The EIS on the Eielson F-35 basing is expected to be finalized by year's end. Dodson says if local support infrastructure construction begins as scheduled next year, the first of the F-35s could arrive by 2019. In Fairbanks, with help from Robert Hannon, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after years of delays, residents of Newtok are ready to move.
Last time, I've been on YouTube before. That time I said I wasn't worried, but now I am.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at ArcticWireRope.com.
The federal government has opened a criminal investigation into the death of 25 Pacific walrus found on an isolated northwest Alaska beach. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokeswoman Crystal Leonetti says agency investigators have not returned from the site at Cape Lisburn, but that the case is now in the hands of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Initial reports last week said the walrus had been shot, but the Fish and Wildlife Service refused to speculate on the cause of death until agency personnel had examined the carcasses. A person connected to an Air Force radar station at Cape Lisburn spotted the animals and notified the agency on Wednesday. The dead animals included 12 pups. Some walrus were missing heads and tusks. Walrus ivory is prized for jewelry and crafts. Starfish from Mexico to Alaska have been hammered by a wasting disease that causes their arms to melt and fall off. But as John Ryan reports from KUCBN on Alaska, sea stars in the Aleutian Islands have not been affected yet.
Sea star wasting disease has turned stars into goo as far north as Alaska's Kenai Peninsula. Researchers believe a virus called adenovirus is behind it. To learn more, they've come out to one of the last starfish strongholds, the Aleutian Islands. Ian Hewson is a microbiology professor at Cornell University. I caught up with him on a beach in Unalaska.
It is definitely the most geographically extensive marine disease ever seen. So it's huge. It's wiped out millions and millions of sea stars. In some cases, up to 95% of the sea stars are gone. Completely changed the coastal ecosystem structure. But fortunately, it hasn't been out here yet.
With help from local divers, Houston has found healthy sea stars from several bays around on Alaska. Divers brought up sun stars, mottled stars, and other species from as deep as 130 feet underwater. Houston is shipping the healthy invertebrates back to his lab in New York now. He says the long trip to the Aleutians and the hassle of shipping water bags with live sea stars across the continent is worth it to find out what makes this disease tick.
This is the only population that's left, pretty much, that is unexposed.
Brenda Kohner with the University of Alaska Fairbanks reports a couple of sunflower stars found off Adak in the far western Aleutians this summer did have the disease, but sunflower stars aren't native out there. Kohner thinks they may have arrived in the ballast water of a big ship. None of the hundreds of native sea stars spotted off Adak showed signs of the disease. Ian Houston says citizen scientists have played a big role in keeping tabs on this underwater outbreak.
And so if you see, you know, diseased sea stars, by all means, take a photograph of it.
And send that photo to a site like seastarwasting.org.
And then that will help us a lot in figuring out, you know, when it actually hits the site. Hopefully it won't hit for a while, but from what we know about this disease, it will probably sweep through here at some stage in the future.
Brenda Kohner with UAF says the virus does better in warmer water, but so little is known about the disease that it's hard to predict when or where it'll stop. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
Residents in the small coastal village of Newtok in southwest Alaska have been preparing to move as erosion eats away at their village. A dispute over who has tribal authority slowed the process, but now that dispute has been decided by federal courts, and a new set of tribal officials are getting the relocation effort underway again. But with climate change accelerating the erosion, many are getting anxious that the move can't happen soon enough. KYUK's Charles Enoch visited Newtok and has this story.
Newtok resident Nathan Tam is living in the house closest to the eroding shoreline. This isn't the first interview for the 31-year-old. In a piece by The Guardian, he explained he wasn't too concerned, but that was 2 years ago.
Last time, I've been on YouTube before. That time I said I wasn't worried, but now I am.
That's because now the home he grew up in is about 100 feet away from the water. Increased storm surges and warming permafrost are washing away between 50 and 75 feet of land each year. Tom predicts he has a couple of years before his house is literally on the brink, and like most residents, he says the move can't come sooner.
I don't know how they're going to do it. We don't exactly know how they're going to do it. I don't want to lose this house because it was my mom's house, grandma, who raised me since I was a baby.
Tom says his house was one of over 20 that were inspected and deemed stable enough to be relocated 9 miles south to the new site called Muhtarvik, or a place to pack water in Yupik, located across the Baird Inlet. But getting there won't be easy as there are no connecting roads in this region of Alaska. This time of year, people get around on foot or with ATVs, navigating a system of sinking boardwalks barely able to keep them out of the mud. Many from the village are out moose hunting during the stormy fall season. Some are picking berries on the tundra. You wouldn't notice the sense of urgency, but the village has been waiting for a decision on a legal dispute between the old tribal council called the Newtok Traditional Council and the new one called the Newtok Village Council. The old traditional council has been in charge of the move since its inception in the 80s, but as state and federal funding become available, many in Newtok began to wonder if their leaders were properly managing the relocation. 49-year Newtok resident Teddy Tom says residents were eventually fed up with the way the old council was running things.
We started to ask questions. What's this road project's going to happen? And they say it's going to happen next year, and it doesn't. And they say we're going to move next year too, and never happened. We got tired of being lied to.
Teddy and many others say villagers petitioned the traditional council to hold an official election, but the council never followed up. The Newtok residents, with the help of state agencies, held their own vote in October 2012 to elect a new council. The results would have swept the old leadership away, but the traditional council said that election wasn't valid, leaving funding agencies with no clear tribal entity to work with. That conflict was resolved in August this year when the Interior Board of Indian Appeals upheld a 2013 BIA ruling, siding with the new village council and providing the new leadership with tribal legitimacy. Now the Newtok Village Council is spearheading the effort, and they say the groundbreaking project is coming together. Romy Cadiente is the Village Council's tribal coordinator. He says there is little room for error this time around.
You look at the eroding shoreline and the imminent flood. We don't have very much time. We need to get this thing right. We need to get it right this time.
Caliente says they are currently re-establishing connections with state and federal agencies to provide funding for the move. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers estimates the move would cost an upwards of $80 to $130 million. Caliente says there are plans to use barges to transport the buildings, though nothing's concrete as of yet. The new tribal administrator, Tom John, says it will be a relief when it happens.
This new site has a beautiful scenery, especially in clear, sunny day. The view is very beautiful, and it's higher ground. We didn't have to worry about high floods.
The new site already has 6 houses. The plans for the new site include 2 intersecting airport runways, plots for houses, a wind farm, a water plant, a small boat harbor, and a community garden, facilities that Nutak residents don't currently have. There is also a foundation for what was supposed to be an evacuation and community center, a critical piece that would have served as a multi-purpose building during the move if it were completed. Tom John says without access to the old council's documentation, it's hard to know exactly what happened.
The old council dissolved the MOA with Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and from there it seemed like everything stopped.
According to an audit done by the State of Alaska Division of Community and Regional Affairs, legislature awarded $4 million to the project in 2010 and $2.5 million again in 2011. The audit brought to light questionable spending and poor accounting practices. According to the Alaska Dispatch, the FBI has made inquiries into the matter. John says only about $1.9 million is left and no one knows for sure how the other part was spent. KYUK contacted several former officials with the Nutak Traditional Council, but they declined to interview. In Nuktak, I'm Charles Enoch.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
Tribal housing in Alaska will benefit from more than $1 million in grants announced today through the Federal Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, program to address concerns over mold. Colleen Bickford is the HUD Field Office Director for Alaska. She says $1.6 million was awarded to 3 tribal entities in the state specifically for mold remediation or prevention in more than 200 tribal homes through improved windows, doors, and exteriors.
But also through this work, ensuring that the interior is also adequately ventilated to ensure good air quality indoors. And that's where preventing moisture buildup, which leads to the growth of mold, which is unhealthy. So this is a kind of a new preventative investment in rural communities.
In the past, HUD had a cookie-cutter approach to housing. It built similar structures across the nation, regardless of local conditions. But Bickford says that's changed as HUD realized local entities better understand their own geographic challenges. In Alaska, that has led to more flexibility to incorporate traditional building methods with new cold-climate housing science for improved regional structures.
Working with the private sector to design housing that fits their geography and their climate and things like that. So we really are not in that driver's seat anymore with Indian housing funding.
Homes with mold problems will be targeted first through assessment by the tribal housing authorities, with $800,000 going to the Cook Inlet Tribal Council, $200,000 to the Yakutat Tlingit Tribe, and $553,000 to the Craig Tribal Association.
In the case of Yakutat, they've identified 30 beneficiary households that they're going to target for education and mold remediation programs and that sort of thing.
Bickford says the other awardees will undertake a similar prioritizing and assessment of housing conditions. Nationally, $12.4 million will go to tribal housing authorities to combat poor ventilation and moisture that leads to mold problems. Students and mariners will soon be able to get formal marine transportation education without leaving the state. The University of Alaska Board of Regents last week approved a new marine transportation degree program at the University of Alaska Southeast. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
For decades, the University of Alaska Southeast has offered classes and trainings to ferry workers, the Coast Guard, shipyard workers, sea pilots, the tug and barge industry, fishing and charter boat captains, and other maritime employees. These classes have never been part of a formal degree program. Dale Miller is a recently retired marine transportation instructor.
In the 14 years I've been with the university, every year students come to us and ask us if we do have a degree program in marine transportation. So there is a demand from the students without us even advertising.
Miller says a formal degree program will allow more students, like military personnel and veterans, to access funding for course tuition.
In the early days, they could receive funding by taking our non-degree classes. But in the last several years, it's changed a lot, and they're a lot more strict with the regulations. They're being denied funding now because we do not have a degree program.
The program approved by the Regents is a two-year Associate of Applied Science degree. Miller says this can go far in helping someone transition to an onshore career.
Hopefully, when people go through that program, they're halfway to a bachelor's, and they would think seriously about continuing their education. And all the different fleet managers, the tourism, the tugboat, the Marine Highway System headquarters in Ketchikan, they all need managers and shoreside support people.
Miller says the degree program will also keep students in the state instead of going elsewhere for a degree in marine transportation.
I think it's a great opportunity for young people in Alaska to be able to get a degree at a lot less cost than leaving the state, paying for room and board, and going to outside institutions and then coming back to the state to work.
More than 430 students took marine transportation classes last year. That number is expected to increase with changing regulations requiring more mariners to take refresher and navigational courses. The associate degree program was originally proposed in 2006 and has been a priority for the Ketchikan campus ever since. The degree program starts this spring. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
As college freshmen dig into their studies at the state's universities this fall, more Native faces are appearing in science and engineering classrooms. That's thanks to the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP. UPIC students from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are among them. Daisha Eaton with member station KYUK has the story about one student's journey from Tuntutuliak to Anchorage.
Cody McIntyre is from the village of Tuntutuliak, or as he calls it, Tunt, and he really likes math.
I don't know, it came easy to me, and it just made sense to me.
He says he wasn't sure about his direction after high school until an ANSEP recruiter came to his school to promote the program. He attended their STEM Ready program through Bethel Regional High School, where he aced Algebra 2 and Calculus, as well as Chemistry and Physics. Now he's starting his freshman year of college at UAA. He also participated in their Summer Bridge program, where ANSEP selects 30 or so students from around the state who want to go into STEM careers. First, they do a math class, and then they do internships. He took a trigonometry class and did an engineering internship with the U.S. Forest Service.
Sometimes I'd go into the supervisor's office and work on office stuff. Sometimes I'd go out in the field. It was like half and half. My supervisor wanted me to get a broad view of what the Forest Service does.
McIntyre says he learned to survey the ground where a parking lot would be built and inspected a remote cabin for repair. His goal, he says, is to get his engineering degree and start his own nonprofit. McIntyre did both ANSEP's Summer Bridge program and also the Acceleration Academy. Michael Ulrun from CHEVAC is the regional director for the ANSEP High School Acceleration Academy at UAA.
They earn college credit, and these courses are taught through university professors, and it gives them that exposure to what it is like to be in a college environment.
Ulrun has a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering and was an ANSEP student himself. Now he's working on a master's degree in construction management. He says not all rural Alaska schools offer higher level math and science classes needed to move on to careers in science and engineering. And ANSEP is critical for bridging that gap. It also helps with exposing students to how life works in urban centers and on college campuses before they get there.
And unless that opportunity is there, then how are you going to know where to go or what to do? And we provide those students firsthand experience.
Cody's mother says that's important for Native students in villages.
Carrie McIntyre, my Yupik name is Ann, and I'm named after my dad's mom.
She says many of them don't have the support to move to an urban center and start college, and family obligations in the village sometimes keep them from going out into the world.
A lot of students nowadays are scared to leave their hometown.
But ANSEP helps them, and parents, she says, also have a responsibility.
I think us parents need to encourage our children to go out and experience what outside life is about. Then they can always come back and do what they want to do after they go to school and graduate and get their degree and that stuff.
That's what her son Cody plans to do. The nonprofit he wants to start, it would work on the huge issue of improving the water system in his village and others where there's no running water and people are still using the honey bucket.
And the organization's mission would be to provide clean, drinkable water to everyone in the village by making a water system in the village and connect them all to all the houses.
And with his freshman year of college underway, he's one step closer to achieving that goal. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, John Ryan in Unalaska, Charles Enoch and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.